Matthew 14, verses 13 to 21. And that's page 22 in the Pew Bible. Jesus feeds a great crowd. When Jesus heard the news about John, he left there in a boat and went to a lonely place by himself. The people heard about it, so they left their towns and followed him by land. Jesus got out of the boat, and when he saw the large crowd, his heart was filled with pity for them, and he healed those who were ill. That evening, his disciples came to him and said, "It's already very late, and it's a lonely place. Send the people away and let them go to the villages to buy food for themselves." "They don't have to leave," answered Jesus. "You yourselves give them something to eat." "All we have here are 5 loaves and 2 fish," they replied. "Then bring them here to me," Jesus said. He ordered the people to sit down on the grass. Then he took the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, looked up to heaven and gave thanks to God. He broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples. And the disciples gave them to the people. Everyone ate and had enough. Then the disciples took up 12 baskets full of what was left over. The number of men who ate was about 5,000, not counting the women and the children.
Thank you very much. Can I have computer 2? Yeah. You've had a busy day. And what, I wonder, are the sort of things that you do to relax? Any suggestions? A cup of tea. Sleep. Sewing. Read a book. Garden. Picking up all those leaves. Wash the car. You're quite energetic here, aren't you? Really? Well, yes, some people might very well open up a bottle of wine. Or you might jump into a hot bath with some relaxing smellies, maybe. And just, and of course, with your trusted rubber duck to help you on your way. You may have a personal foot massage that you might get into one of those. Or if you're one of these very lucky and special people and have an electronic spa in your garden with, I don't know, 72 jets of water, you might jump into one of those in your garden. Or you might get your partner to give you a back and shoulder massage to ease all that tension out of your muscles. Or maybe you turn on the TV and put your feet up and watch some of your favourite television programs. Whatever takes your fancy, I suppose. The disciples had just spent a very long day with Jesus. And, of course, it had been through the heat of the day, much worse than today. And Jesus himself had had a particularly rough day. Not only had he been out walking and about, talking with the disciples and the following crowds, as happened most days, teaching and performing many miracles and healings. But on this particular day, he had received some very bad news, news that must have shocked him to the core. For our Bibles tell us that he had heard of the death of his cousin John the Baptist, as we know him. John had just been beheaded by Herod. And John's own disciples had come and found Jesus and told him personally of the news. Maybe it was a way of warning him that Jesus might very well be next, and therefore to avoid danger. Maybe they wished to report to Jesus what had happened and where they had buried John's body so that Jesus himself could go and pay his last respects. Who knows? We just simply do not know. But Jesus seems to take the news quite badly. All he wanted to do was to withdraw away into a private place, maybe to grieve, maybe just to think and pray, as is activity in momentous times like this in his life. But maybe he also wanted to just sit down and relax a little bit, maybe with his friends, his disciples. And certainly on this occasion, Jesus wanted company. He didn't want to be by himself. He wanted the company of his disciples. So he dismissed the crowds, and he got into a boat, and he set off across the Sea of Galilee. But the crowds were not that cooperative. Word had already started to penetrate in the surrounding towns and villages about Jesus' miraculous power and his unrivaled and uncompromising teaching. The people were drawn to him. They flocked to see this traveling prophet whenever he was in their area. And so no sooner had Jesus and his disciples started on this journey across the Sea of Galilee, but speculation started as to where's Jesus going? Where is he heading? And those who could quickly journeyed on foot around the coastline to continue being with this remarkable man. What Jesus thought would be a remote part of the coast near Bethsaida, where he could spend some quality time, some quiet time with his disciples, was soon to be gatecrashed by thousands of people. 5,000 men, we're told, the gospel writers tell us. Apart from, of course, women and children who would have been part of that gathering. Now, I don't know about you, but when I start my day, particularly if I'm at work, I have worked out my activities and tasks for the day and things that I'm going to start focusing on. I like to be organized, even to the extent of organizing in minute detail not only the weekday's activities at work, but to Mary's exasperation, I also do the same thing for weekends. She just seems to want to go with the flow. Well, what gets done, and what doesn't, well, we'll wait for another day. But with the problem of planning to such an extent, I end up with interruptions. And to be honest, who needs them? It's so annoying at work that I'm just about to settle down and do a piece of work and complete something, then the phone rings or the emails go, or somebody comes to my desk with an urgent problem. A member of staff has a problem and wants to ask a question. I have churches phoning up with specific financial questions as to how they should be dealing with certain things in their financial accounts. I have computer problems, and this last week has been absolutely horrendous with computer problems, which has delayed me much more than I was expecting. Or my boss decides he wants a piece of work or he wants some information done. Well, his work takes priority over mine, doesn't it? And most of the time, interruptions, perhaps maybe for all of us, are just minor annoyances that temporarily distract us from what we're trying to do or what we're trying to achieve. It's those times when things don't go right and the things are planned get askewed. I don't know if you recognize that sort of a feeling. It's certainly a constant thing in my life. In his book, Reaching Out, the Three Movements of Spiritual Life, Henry Newman acknowledged that we often react to constant interruptions with frustration and even anger. But he asked what if our interruptions might actually be our opportunities? What if all the unexpected interruptions are in fact invitations to open up a new unexplored areas of experience, or to do things in a slightly different way from the way that we've normally done them? Now, I appreciate that there are interruptions and there are interruptions. There are those minor little inconveniences which blow us off track for just a short while, but that we're able to get back onto our planned schedule again in a short while. But then, of course, there's those huge interruptions which are so life-changing that our little world rocks and shakes with uncertainty. The loss of a job or the loss of a friend or partner or family member. Or when we hear about the diagnosis of some serious illness, and so we have to focus our attention to a specific way from now on. Or we're affected by external events like ferocious storms or tsunamis or floods. You see, interruptions can either make or they can break us. We can either learn from these experiences or we can become resentful, perhaps blaming others, maybe even God himself, for the interruptions. And by doing so, we fail to grasp the new opportunities that we can learn, or that God is trying to reveal to us, or maybe even preparing us for a greater service for ministry. Henry Newman tells in this book of an incident where, while he was visiting the University of Notre Dame, where he had taught for many, many years previously, he met up with an older and more experienced professor who had spent most of his life at the university. And while the two men strolled over the campus grounds chatting to each other, the professor started to say in a very melancholy voice, "You know, my whole life I have been complaining that my work was constantly interrupted until I discovered that my interruptions were my work." Interruptions were my work. And I can somehow identify with that, and I'm sure that Jesus could as well. For Jesus was constantly bombarded with people's problems, their illnesses, their requests. Jesus had interruption after interruption after interruption. And yet he was prepared to respond not with ill feeling or anger or frustration, as perhaps we might in a very similar situation, but he responded to them as opportunities to do good, to view them as invitations to display God's kingdom in an attitude of love and compassion. So I can empathize with Jesus here in Bethsaida, where the disciples had landed. Jesus knew what he wanted to do, and that was to be in a remote place with his disciples. And yet that wasn't to be. He was about to be interrupted by this vast crowd who wanted more and more of his time. Sometimes we do not recognize God's work to be done. Instead, we see only interruptions, don't we? Interruptions that get in the way of what we want to be doing. Even if we sometimes think that we know what we want to be doing in the first place, and this is what God wants us to do. But Jesus knew that sometimes events and sometimes in situations change without much notice, which may blow us off course from the current or expected activity. And the result, to reassess one's priorities and activities and see them as new opportunities. And today was just one of those days. The interruption of his day was important. The people needed him. And so they were now his priority. Not him, not his disciples. And so he taught them. He healed them. All that were brought to him that day. And the more he healed, the more in number came to seek wholeness and healing from him, from the surrounding villages. It was a never-ending queue. And at the end of the evening, as disciples were starting to get restless, maybe even resentful for the crowd's interruption, They wanted to spend some time with Jesus. And besides, they were starting to feel rather hungry. They hadn't eaten all day. So what better way than to get rid of this vast crowd, get Jesus to send them away on the premise that it's now dinner time. As evening approached, we read, the disciples came to him and said, "This is a remote place and it's already getting late. Send the crowds away so that they can go to the villages and buy themselves food." Now, what the disciples didn't expect was the response that Jesus gave them. "They do not need to go away. You give them something to eat." I'm sure the disciples would have looked aghast at the implications of what Jesus was asking for. How can we? Look at this number. I don't know how you generally react and respond when plans that you have made start to unravel and go wrong. As I said, I'm quite methodical and meticulous in my approach to planning. I've even been known to plan being spontaneous. Mary and I were off on our holiday a couple of years ago in Corfu. And we arrived at our airport with plenty of time, an hour and a half before check-in. Unfortunately, we failed to find the prepaid car park. Now, very early in the morning, what time was it? Four o'clock in the morning. There weren't that many people around. Those who were around, we asked the taxi driver, we asked the BP petrol station attendant, but to no avail. We just could not find our car park. We finally located it off airport and deposited our key with the attendants. And as we waited for the shuttle bus, which would then take us the 4 miles back to Luton Airport, you can imagine with horror when we noticed on the LED display units that our flight was now boarding. They were boarding without us. We finally got to the check-in desk with supposedly 5 minutes before it was due to shut, but they had already closed it. And consequently, we missed our departure flight. Now, in such circumstances, when expected plans change, our minds tend to go into overdrive, don't they? Well, at least mine does. We had to make some very quick decisions and analysis of the known facts and options. When was the next flight? What time does it go? Where does it go from? If it's on a different day, well, where are we going to spend the night or nights waiting? If it's from a completely different airport, well, how are we going to get to there? How do we pay for these unexpected changes? Now, Philip, one of the disciples often associated with being fairly level-headed and analytical, pipes up, as recorded by John's Gospel, that it would take more than half a year's wages, about 200 denarii. And where are we going to get and spend that amount on food, on bread and give them to eat, he says. Now, Philip appears to be one of these guys who was highly practical and yet always thinking of the bottom line. Now, some commentators even suggest that he was in charge of the supplies and food. Now, in today's terms, with the average wage of 26,500, that's a staggering £13,000 that was being expected to be found to buy food for this multitude. Now, even Wonga wouldn't come up with that sort of cash so quickly, despite their claims on TV. This was a huge logistical challenge and a demand to place on the disciples, and Philip in particular. What on earth was Jesus thinking of? Andrew, Peter's younger brother, seems to be a little bit realistic. He notices a little boy who had with him 5 barley loaves and 2 small fish within the crowd. But, well, come on. How good is that for so many? For all his realism and down-to-earth nature, Andrew cannot see beyond the realization of the insufficiency of these minimal resources on offer. And in reality, it was a pitiful amount of food. The fish would have been similar to 2 small sardines. Well, you know how small sardines are. And the loaves would have been 2 small bread rolls. Just enough to feed a small boy for his lunch. Not a family, let alone a vast crowd. But how like Philip and Andrew we often are. How often do we sometimes fail to recognize the resources that we have been given? Now, most of you know that I am the accountant for the Baptist Union and have also been involved in church finances for many, many decades now. And one of the challenges for me when I'm thinking about budgets or a large project that we might have to get involved with is that I can compute the expected costs and the known income that we've got, and there's always a shortfall, isn't there? Have you ever come across that? There's always a shortfall of income to balance the books. And if I was to be totally pragmatic and realistic, I would look at the accounts and the activity under consideration and say, well, it's just not financially viable. It's not feasible to go ahead with this. We either have to cut back on our expenditure or scrap the project altogether because it just can't work. But I'll let you into a little secret. John, you need to shut your ears here. Or maybe you know the secret already and you just haven't shared it with the rest of the congregation. Now, I'll share this little secret, but, you know, this is between you and me, okay? This isn't public knowledge, and it's certainly not Baptist Union guidelines. You see, what Christian accountants like me often have to realize, what we have to learn and what we have to comprehend is that there is a hidden income line that's never shown in any projections or budgets. Can you believe that? A hidden line. I suppose it's what you might call a form of Christian creative accounting. Now, you actually don't see this line, and when John produces his budget, it'll never be up on the screen or on the form itself. But it often goes under the heading of work of the Holy Spirit. You see, I have learned, as so many Christian accountants have before me, but unlike Jesus' disciples, we cannot necessarily quantify the resources of God for him to complete his work through us. The resources that we have may be small. They may very well be insignificant in human terms, but perfectly adequate for God. So sometimes we think that we have to learn that the aspect of faith and trust in God. For he always ensures that there is enough provision to accomplish his purposes. Now, whether that be a calling he might be making towards us, God will provide all that we need, together with all the necessary gifts and abilities. You see, miracles are strange things, but one thing that we can say is that they are not illusions, as we might see with Dynamo or Paul Daniels on television. Recently, Mary came across a nice little definition of what a miracle is during her studies. A miracle is not the revelation of natural law, but an event that pierces our dullness or despair to convince us of the presence and power of God's. Now, I know for some that some people, they would like to denigrate this story of the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000. Well, of course, they can say that this little boy brought out his packed lunch, and everyone else saw that he'd done that, so they brought out their packed lunch, and that's how everyone got fed. Now, if that's the way you want to read the story, that's fine. But in which case, the miracle is not about the turning of the five loaves and two small fishes, five fishes and the two loaves, but the turning of a stubborn and unsharing heart into an attitude of communal sharing and giving. But most of us would want to see and understand this story as purely a miracle of the multiplication of the earthly elements of food from the loaves and fish. Enough to feed thousands of hungry people and for them to have their full fill. But the truth still remains. We sometimes, when it comes to faith issues or work in the kingdom of God, we fail to recognize the resources that we have been given. We focus not on God's promises, but on the tangible things, the things that we can see and feel and touch. God doesn't call the equipped, but he does equip the called. And there's a huge difference there. For whenever God calls us to something, he is completely faithful. He will give us what we need to accomplish the task to which he's calling us. I know new ministries, opportunities can be scary and can often make us nervous. And so we start to doubt and question, well, I'm no good. What if I can't cope? What if? But if we're certain that God has called us to do something, we can be sure that he's going to equip us to carry out what he's called us to do. Not necessarily in our time plan, but he will in his timing to fulfill the plans that he has for us. And so finally, we've looked and considered that sometimes we don't recognize God's work. Perhaps we're seeing interruptions instead. We fail to recognize the resources that God will provide to fulfill his work and actions to us. But sometimes we also fail to identify the unbounding nature of God's provision. In this story of the feeding of the 5,000, that's men, don't forget, plus women, plus children. The disciples were asked to gather up the remaining food so none would be wasted. And as they gathered and gathered and gathered, the extent of the amount of food that was available became apparent. 12 fishing baskets were filled that evening, full of the uneaten food. Now, this amazing story is in this gospel in which it's recorded in full, and yet it's in all four of the gospels, which in biblical terms stresses the significance and the real importance that we should be placing on this story. For it's not just a nice, neat little story about an amazing day which took place 2,000 years ago on the banks of the Sea of Galilee, where Jesus fed a multitude, but instead, this story speaks and it captures the very essence of God's abundant and extravagant generosity and grace. The disciples saw this miracle at first hand. I'm not really sure that they fully understood or appreciated what had actually just happened before their very eyes. You see, it's not just about the loaves and the fish, small and insignificant as they were. What they failed to realize and understand was the real source of supply in Jesus. The disciples looked at what they had. In this case, what they didn't have. How could they feed this amount of people? And so logically, they came to a conclusion that there was nothing that they could do but to send the people away. It was only because Jesus himself specifically asked them, "What do you have?" They actually discovered that in reality, they did have something. 5 loaves and 2 small fish. But even that they saw as inadequate. But was it? How often we fail to identify the unbounding nature of God's provision. How often have we felt that we should be doing something in particular in a particular situation or to help and assist somebody in need? But hey, what difference can we make? My contribution is so small. It's too insignificant. We're called to reach out to world poverty. God, you're having a laugh with us. Me? What can I do? I'm just a pensioner. How often have we felt God calling us either as a church or as a family or as an individual to actually do something, but hey, we don't have the gifts. I don't have the patience, or I don't have much patience for that. How can I stand up and speak publicly? How can I read in church? How can I preach? How can I lead in prayer? You know, Moses had the same problem. And he complained to God, "Well, I'm no orator. Send somebody else." But God said, "No, you're the one I want to send. You're the person I want." How often have we wanted to help out in the community center or the local charity shop? Offering our services to help in that this or that organization, the homeless or the jobless, the drug addicts, those in our neighborhood who are desperately in need of financial or emotional support. You see, God not only equips us for the work which he calls us to do, he won't expect us manage on our own. But the little we do offer him can be used and multiplied by him for his glory. He expects us to bring that which we have already, even if it's loaves and fish. No, of course, we may not be able to feed all the hungry in our society. We may not even be able to feed 10 or 20 people. But a can of beans here or a can of fruit there into the food bank collection box can be used to go so far in God's hands. My aunt, until she recently lost her sight and stopped her from going shopping, always used to go into the shops and pick up the buy one, get one free offers. Everyone has seen those. Why? Why did she do it? Was it because she was poor? Nope, not really. Because that extra item, which actually cost her nothing, she donated to the homeless, to the local hospice, the local food bank. It was all that she could do, given her financial situation. But all through these bog-offs promotions, so many extra people were helped and supported and blessed through her and others like her. When we respond to God with, "Lord, I can do something with the little I've got," miracles can and do happen. And people are literally fed, and they are fed spiritually as well. So we've considered this little story of the feeding of the 5,000. Let me ask you, how do you respond when your plans are interrupted? Do we see them as opportunities or as just one of life's little inconveniences? What would it take for you to view interruptions the way that Jesus does? And then in relation to the loaves and the fishes in the story, how do we recognize the real worth of the things that we do and have access to, and which can be used and be blessed by God? Now, yes, they might be small. They might be significant in our eyes, but perhaps even useless. But the little they are can be used by God to bless and further the work of his kingdom in your life, in your world, and in the world beyond you. For when we respond to God, I can do something, miracles do happen. Because we are actually tapping in into the unbound nature of God's extravagant provision of grace and generosity. Thanks be to God.